Well, I'm joined today by my good friend Jason Jones. He's a champion for the pro-life movement. He is an activist in the anti-war movement, and he's also a film producer. And he's someone that I enjoy talking with, and I consider him a friend and fellow in arms to the for the message of Jesus' peace and solidarity with victims, no matter how big or small. So, Jason, you have a new project. Would you mind telling us about this new project that you're the director of and founder?
Yeah, sure. So thank you for having me on your show, by the way. And as a Girardian, it's always great to talk to another Girardian. You would think that Rene Girard would be a household name.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like belonging to this beautiful secret society, which wasn't so secret. So it's great to be on your show. The mission of Servium USA, I use the Catholic word. I'm a Catholic. My apostolate. You know, my apostolate is to promote the incomparable dignity of the human person and to protect the vulnerable from violence. And Servium USA is an organization that we've just created as another instrument of this sort of overall apostolate. But what it does specifically is it promotes authentic, historic Catholic social teaching. And it also seeks to sort of unmask the victimist organizations that try to harness the prestige of Catholic social teaching and the empathy towards victims to gain political power. They've turned Catholic social teaching today really is nothing but an instrument of victimists to achieve ideological and political objectives. Thomas Sowell, I was listening to his new book, he said that, you know, social justice today is really the opposite of that. It's, you know, anti-social justice in his new book, The Quest for Cosmic Justice. And in many ways, Catholic social teaching, what we see presented as Catholic social teaching is anti-Catholic social teaching. And Rene Girard said, you know, the apocalypse will come when there is no one left to stand in solidarity with the victims, with the vulnerable. And that's what's happening. We're seeing Catholic social teaching being used as an instrument against the vulnerable rather than a shield of protection for the vulnerable.
Well, very interesting. Can you flesh out a little bit of what authentic Catholic social teaching looks like for the average layman that wants to really dive into what you're doing at this website and understand, okay, I'm hearing some Catholics talk about things that I think are leftist. You're saying that's a diversion from the authentic teaching. So give us maybe a few basic principles that are guiding systems for this.
There's five sort of fundamental pillars of historic, traditional Catholic social teaching. And really, what does Catholic social teaching mean? There's no magisterium. You'll hear people talk about the social magisterium, and they treat it as dictates from, you know, Communist Party central headquarters that we all have to obey. There's really no such thing. Catholic social teaching is simply laymen, priests, bishops, doctors of the church, you know, saints, just Christians, trying to apply the gospel to the realities of living in political communities and in commonwealths, and trying to live as Christians within a political community. And those five pillars of Catholic social teaching, and by the way, it allows for a broad diversity in political opinions, you really can't look to Catholic social teaching and say, okay, you know, Catholic social teaching says that there must be a minimum wage of X amount of dollars, or carbon tax credits this, or this specific position on immigration. And maybe we could talk more about immigration later. It doesn't work that way, although people will pretend that it does. And again, that's trying to rob the prestige of Catholic social teaching, which is tempting. We all want to advance our objectives to try to serve the common good, but it really is, it creates scandal. That's not what it is. There are five basic pillars. The first pillar is the Christian truth, the Christian anthropological truth that became clearly evident as Christians tried to comprehend what it meant for the second person of the Trinity to become a man, to become a human person. And so that first principle of Catholic social teaching is the Imago Dei, or the Christian anthropological truth that we are creatures with an incomparable dignity, beauty, and worth, made in the image and likeness of God, made evident through the incarnation. But it's really self-evident. Even when I was an atheist, I was an Ayn Rand objectivist. I was a Randian. What was attractive to about Ayn Rand to me is really this exalted vision of the human person that she presented. So as an eighth grader, when I first read Anthem, and that beautiful sequence of the protagonist discovering discovering the word I rather than we, that at that moment really just revealed to me what I knew, that the human person had this dignity. Well, Christian anthropology presents the source of that dignity, that mysterious source. So that's number one, the Imago Dei, or the dignity of the human person, or Christian personalism. There's a lot of ways to say it. Number two is the transcendent moral order. So there's a transcendent moral order that stands above culture, customs, mores, and even, believe it or not, posited law, even above legislatures, even above the Supreme Court, even above the editorial page of the New York Times, even above Jimmy Kimmel. There's a transcendent moral order, and we can judge other opinions and laws by, man-made laws by. Three is subsidiarity. Subsidiarity is just the truth that the further an institution is away from you, the less influence that institution should have in your life. The closer an institution is to you, you know, your mom, your dad, your wife, your children, your neighbors, your friends, your coworkers, the people you go to church with, the more influence they should have in your life. And we can look to the 20th century and the obliteration of those free institutions of civil society, those little societies between the person and the state, led to just horrible genocides and democides. There was nothing to shelter the vulnerable from the chaotic and violent forces that swirl. There were no family. The family was made impotent. The church was made impotent. So that's subsidiarity. Four is solidarity, which, of course, René Girard really focused so much for me. You know, when I first started reading Girard, it's as if I didn't know I needed glasses and I didn't see anything different. But I saw vivid, bold, what I already was looking at, I saw in even more striking and vivid and bold relief, especially solidarity. And solidarity is our burden, our obligation, our privilege to share the burdens of the vulnerable. And when we become vulnerable, and when we are vulnerable, to with graciousness allow others to share our burdens. And that's it. Solidarity is a two-way street, David. One day, you and I are going to be sick. About 2 years ago, I collapsed with something called exertional rhabdomyolysis. I'm a very big, strong man who became helpless. And, you know, it took a little Filipino nurse to help keep me alive. And so it's with graciousness that we allow others to share their strengths with us. And with humility, we share our strengths with others. That's solidarity. And then five is the humane economy. The Catholic Church in the late 19th and early 20th century struggled with totalitarian socialism. And it's really the fundamental importance of private property rights in as a foundation of a just social order. But this isn't sort of a libertarian absolute right to property, but that we hold property as stewards for commonwealths, many commonwealths, our family, our neighborhood, our community, our posterity, of course, because we're going to die and that piece of land we own is going to go on. So those are the five principles of Catholic social teaching. And what I would say, just, you know, I want to go back to solidarity. The real danger for those of us who, to use a popular expression, are quote unquote woke, And what is woke? It means you've been hurt. You have empathy and sympathy, probably because of some experience that you've suffered, maybe sexual abuse as a child or losing a loved one to a violent crime or something you experienced as a young man in the military. Something really awakened, you know, woke you to the truth of human vulnerability and the truth of human beauty. The real danger, though, is to go to become some kind of do-gooder. And victimism is the word for that. You know, it's when you go from trying to live in solidarity with the vulnerable to being lured to exploiting the vulnerable. And that's really dangerous. But what Rene Girard taught me about solidarity is there's no way that you can be in solidarity with the vulnerable in which you yourself don't become vulnerable. And that's the key. You know, is this, you go to Skid Row every morning and you're going to get lice. You're going to get sick from time to time. You might even get punched in the face or a bottle thrown at your head. But that's okay. That's the cost of trying to live in solidarity with folks who struggle with mental illness or addiction, is that you might get popped in the eye, and that's fine. So those are the five core principles of Catholic social teaching. And again, even those principles will be presented by other folks differently. And these aren't party. This isn't a party platform. This is just our attempt as Christians to love our neighbor and to love God, grounded in the transcendent truth of our creation and also our transcendent destiny, that we have a destiny that is beyond this earth, and we have a dignity that comes from our creation.
Well, very good. Yeah, this is very similar to what I'm doing with A Neighbor's Choice, trying to get people to imitate Jesus as they consider their role in civic life, including voting, including being on a jury duty, and also all the little things in between, like you illustrated in your principles, being able to be in solidarity with those who are victims of afflictions and sins and even the state's oppression. I've tried to summarize it as no violence for nonviolence. So, you know, Christians, Jesus teaches us, do not resist evil with violence. And so from that principle, we can learn that if we find a drug offense to be evil, we cannot use violence to initiate aggression against someone to change that evil, but rather we need to come alongside them and use mercy and also tough love, but not violent. You know, we have to bear the burden with our neighbor and not say, well, we'll just send you over to the bludgeon of the state and throw you in a cage like an animal because you have an addiction to a substance, or there's, you know, because of the nanny state, there's thousands of laws against nonviolent behaviors, you know, everything from broken taillights to suspended licenses to selling raw milk to alternative medicine or, you know, indigenous medicine.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, David. Like, I like taking the controversial or the hard issues.
Right.
Catholic social teaching is not libertarian. It is not statist. And it is not pacifist. Catholic social teaching really is grounded in the idea that the state does have the obligation and the duty to work for the common good. And so Catholics can disagree. Let's just take, for example, the criminalization of marijuana, where I believe today in our country, to serve the common good, decriminalization of marijuana would be the best way to do that. Where I wouldn't agree that decriminalizing heroin would serve the common good. Where now, as a Catholic, you can be a libertarian, and you can make libertarian arguments to say this is what best serves the Catholic vision of the human person. But what one couldn't do is pretend the Catholic social teaching has this sort of vision that the state doesn't have the right to do that. The Catholic social teaching believes that the state does have the right to initiate violence. It's not pacifist at all, but it does greatly restrict the use of violence. And when you are grounded in the understanding of, the Catholic Church has a very grand and old just war tradition. It also has a tradition of pacifism. But the tradition of pacifism is for people, for individuals, distinct from what is the role of the state. So one could be a libertarian, I mean, one could be a pacifist and be a Catholic. It's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, what I'm talking about is not pacifism, but rather a simple, you know, non-aggression and non-revenge. So there's no vengeance and there's no room for aggression. But so I would just, it's just an interesting discussion. So just to parse that out a little bit more, do you see that within Catholic teaching that there's a, is it ever okay to use violence to solve a matter of the heart? If it's not, see, so basically what I would say is law is immutable. And so it's not up for legislation. Law is based in God's moral law, and it's not, it doesn't change. And so the moment you open up the legislative concept of law, you create positivism.
What?
You create this sense where the crowd's whims can criminalize virtually anything. There's really no standard at that
point. Well, what the church would say, you know, traditionally how this would be discussed is, it doesn't serve the common good to criminalize every sin, right? So obviously to do that would create sort of this horrible Orwellian, you know, totalitarian world. What's interesting is it's been the atheist regimes of the 20th century that have become scrupulous in trying to punish everything that they determine to be immoral. Even today, you'll see, you know, the spirit of the age trying to criminalize the use of gender pronouns.
Right.
Can you believe? They're making it illegal to use gender pronouns.
Right.
This is the spirit of the age. So I find that the spirit of the age is totalitarian, always. And the spirit of the age changes. But the church does believe, for example, that, yeah, of course the state has the right to initiate violence. If you have, I want to start a business, I fly to Thailand, I offer to pay some girls there to come work for me in a brothel in Los Angeles. They consent to work for $5 an hour. I fly them here. I open up a business. Yeah, of course, the police have the right to kick down my door, throw me to the floor, handcuff me, and cart me off to jail because the state has the obligation to protect and promote the common good, to protect the vulnerable from exploitation. But, you know, and for example, marijuana may, you know, let's just take heroin, for example. The state has the obligation to promote the common good, and heroin clearly undermines common good. But if you had 90% of Americans using heroin, disobeying the law, rampant corruption, I think Catholics could then make a prudential argument that, you know, at this point, criminalizing this drug is undermining the common good because it's empowering organized crime, it's encouraging corruption, yada, yada. But, and then the only reason I'm making these points is because, you know, I am a conservative with libertarian leanings. And why is that? Well, I was born into and born of the Anglo-American political tradition. And that's where my natural sentiments are. I lean towards libertarianism. And you will find, you know, Anglo people in our Anglo-American political community who are Catholics who will try to canonize sort of the Anglo-American political tradition. We have a pope who has a tradition, and it comes from a culture where the Anglo-American political community is alien to him. And he is trying to, you know, and he speaks out against how we in our community, in our country, work to solve these prudential problems, how we work to care for the poor. And that creates scandal. And that's the last thing I want to do, is create scandal. But I think when we speak about the diversity, the beauty and the diversity and the freedom of Catholic social teaching, that creates charity. I don't get angry at a liberal because he's always offering kind of these statist solutions. But, you know, you'll hear, and by the way, conservatives generally don't do that. You'll see, even in the Girardian community, and then maybe we can talk about this, it's sad. I see a lot of victimism where they scapegoat conservatives or libertarians as haters of the poor. They'll use this language. They'll use, you know, the language of the scapegoat. They'll throw it on the conservative or the libertarian rather than listening to what they're saying, that we believe by removing the state from healthcare, from the economy, that this gives real opportunity to the poor. They don't look to the evidence. They'll just say, oh, you're a conservative. You're opposed to Obamacare. You hate the poor.
Yeah. Well, Hegel, you know, he, one of their godfathers, Hegel, kind of had this view that the state was like a god, you know, that it was like Holy Spirit community instead of, it was trying to basically supplant the church's role in society. But, you know, Marx took it and, you know, other down the line cultural Marxists have taken it to be a kind of, it's a, I pictured as the scapegoat with a machine gun. So it's almost like the revenge of the nerds Christianity, where instead of mercy, not sacrifice, it's you victimized me or you victimized different class groups based on external characteristics like gender or race. And so therefore you forfeited your right to have me treat you with anything but sacrificial violence. And so it's like a revenge scapegoating in the name of defending victims from prior scapegoatings, right? Don't you see that as what's taking place?
Yeah, oh, for sure. And they'll even say that.
Yeah. See, in my opinion, and again, I think there's common ground here with this, is that the only way we can preserve this cultural war from just breaking down everything we hold dear, including our churches, is if we come to a kind of detente where we learn to, at the same time, drop our scapegoats. So the right tends to have its own scapegoats, and it says, yeah, throw them to the wolves. I don't care. No mercy. Just sacrifice. And then the left has its own little pet scapegoats, like the rich or whatever, that they want to just say, you know, terrorize them, blame them for everything. Let's just demonize them and otherize them. And kind of, to me, the church steps in and says, hey, both of everyone drop the scapegoat. It's like a Mexican standoff. Everybody's got a gun to the victim. It's like everybody drop the guns and let the victims down. Stop it. That's the only way, you know.
Don't drop the scapegoats. Become the scapegoat.
Right.
When you become in solidarity with the vulnerable, you are becoming a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real check. You know, is what I'm advocating, to use Steve Bannon's language, is the New York Times, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and Jimmy Kimmel all on the same page, and that's my page, you know? Maybe, and I'm throwing rocks at the people they're throwing rocks at, maybe I'm engaged in scapegoating.
Mm-hmm.
Am I risking alienating my, you know, and for example, what's the scapegoat of our society? It's so obvious. Even Girardians don't want to say it. Of course they don't, because most of them are normal people. The scapegoat of our age. Who is the innocent, most vulnerable member of our family, the human family, today in the West, the United States, that we blame for global warming, we blame for future poverty, we blame for disenfranchising young women for their future opportunities, we blame for causing crime? If you read Freakonomics, they're the cause of all the crime in society. Who is it, David? Do you know who it is?
Was the unborn child?
It's the human being in the world, in the womb. Mm-hmm. Clearly a human person. Clearly has incomparable dignity and beauty and worth. And how many Girardians have joined the mob, have danced to the tune of the spirit of the age, who pick up rocks and who throw them at the child in the womb, who throw them at those who defend the child in the womb.
And it starts a scapegoating in the classic sense, as Girard defines it, starts with the false accusation, right? And so yeah. The false accusation in this case is that the child is some kind of invader into the womb, as if he wasn't invited, you know, by the act of procreation. Now, I understand with rape it gets a little more tricky there, but it's still this kind of false accusation leveled at the child, which is you're an invasive person, and not only are you an invader, you're not a person.
You're a parasite.
You're a parasite. So we've dehumanized the child to the point where, just like in a classic scapegoating situation, remember in classic scapegoating you would see the idea of like the Minotaur, the mixture of man and beast, right? That was the otherizing of a common victim to the point where they weren't fully human anymore. And at the same token, we're doing that you're saying here with the human child.
Exactly. Hold on, you're exactly right.
So how do we rekindle a common voice, not only in the Catholic Church, but, you know, the other Christian groups in America, so that we can kind of try to find a common ground to break through this noise of the left and right and the shrillness that we see, where it almost is impossible to have a conversation? It seems like Christians are supposed to be the peacemakers. We're supposed to be the ones that, in imitation of Jesus, can walk into a crowd of Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes and say, hey, here's the way of God, you know, and it's not going to make everybody happy. In fact, it's going to cut us all to our hearts and break us all down. But here's how we actually have one body in Christ without this constant sniping and escalating scapegoating of all of our problems in society. What's the way to build that unified voice that can cut through all the noise and be the voice of the Lamb, be the voice of all victims of all sizes, from the unborn to the person overseas who's caught up in some kind of Machiavellian war scheme and is killed just because he's in the wrong country at the wrong time? How do we begin to build that one voice? Yeah, that's what Jesus said before he died on the cross. He said, I wish above all that they were one, as you and I are one. And that unity in our culture is satanic. It's founded on the exclusion of another. But we have to build that oneness that Jesus talked about.
Yeah, but we won't. And that's okay. You know, we're called to be a sign of contradiction. The best way to have that oneness is just to have charity, to be charitable. You know, when I come across somebody who's pro-abortion, of course they are. Of course they are. They're corresponding to the spirit of the age. When I opposed the invasion of Iraq and was called a warmonger, of course I was. When I opposed the early withdrawal of Iraq that left the Yazidis and others open to the inevitable genocide, I was called a warmonger. Of course I was. I was called a pacifist when I opposed the invasion. I was a warmonger when I opposed the early withdrawal, as I'm sure you were and a lot of people listening were. And then when I was speaking out against toppling Assad, I was called, I want to coddle a dictator. I'm a pacifist. Here we go again. You know, here we go. Of course we are. René Girard said that the mimetic spirit, you know, is so powerful that even, it to me, his most beautiful lectures on Peter's denial, that even Peter, and by the way, even you and I, like, we get swept away. So the best thing we need to do is just to be vigilant with ourselves, to walk that tightrope, to not go from being in solidarity with the victim to a victimist, which we can do in the blink of an eye. And then we look back at our life, and then we could see we spent our entire life exploiting the vulnerable rather than serving them. We spent our whole life doing work that we thought was kind and good and just. But in reality, what we were doing is we were helping to rip away defenses for the vulnerable. So I think it's enough to keep ourselves in line, that battle, to share the beauty of the human person, to share the call to solidarity, to be forgiving, to be understanding, to know, you know, I chuckle. I mean, when I see the victimism going on in the Girardian community now, I chuckle. Of course. I mean, if Peter, the follower of Christ, got swept away by the crowd, well, of course, even some of Girard's best students will get swept away by the crowd. Right. Even you, David, might get swept away. I might get swept away by the crowd. But we have to be like Peter. We have to hear that cock crow. And then we have to double back. And, you know, the only reason that I was sent on this journey was because my child was destroyed in the third trimester by a forced abortion on my high school girlfriend. And that experience, burned into my soul a desire to live a life to protect the weak from violence. If not for that horrible tragedy, I would never think about these things. It would never cross my mind. I wouldn't, you know, my whole life trajectory would have changed. I would have gone on to play football at college, majored in phys ed, taught gym and taught football. I would have never thought about these things. I had a life vision plan. So those of us listening, I know, David, you don't have to tell me what it was. I don't know what it was. But we had, like, we, as a filmmaker, you know, we call it the call to adventure. It's that experience of some great injustice. That's what everyone listening to this podcast has in common. I doubt very many, you know, maybe there's somebody who their call to adventure is reading a book. I think most of it's being, you know, the victim of some great injustice. And you don't want anyone to feel like you felt. You don't want anyone to feel helpless and vulnerable. You were left alone, and so you commit not to leaving anyone else alone to the best of your ability. That's what we all have in common, I think, listening to your show. So let's do the best to not become victimists ourselves. That's the real challenge.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the mimetic scapegoating starts with envy. And I think the Christian positive mimesis, that means positive imitation rather than negative, you know, scandal-driven imitation. We should replace that envy with gratitude. So if we have a spirit of gratitude, that gratefulness and thanksgiving, that posture that we carry in our spirit, will be contagious, just like the spirit of envy and resentment is contagious in the way the world, you know, builds its unity. You know, envy and resentment snowballs, and then it finds a common enemy. And we have to be kind of reversing that snowball contagion with a snowball contagion of gratitude and thanksgiving so that it's contagious. Other people say, you know what? I am grateful. I don't need to tear you down because you're successful, or, you know, I have resentments in my past because of people like you.
Yeah, envy. Escaping from envy is such an important thing. You know, one of my blessings in life is nobody expected much of me. I was last in my class in high school. I dropped out, joined the Army the day I turned 17. When I graduated from basic training, to me, I was a bigger success at that point in life than anyone ever expected. I did more than anyone, I think, would have expected from me. Then when I got out of the Army and I went to college, I went to community college, got an associate's degree. That was more than anyone had hoped for me. Then I went to the University of Hawaii, got a bachelor's degree, more than anyone would have hoped for me. More than I expected for myself. So I never had the opportunity to feel envious. I was just always grateful to have made what I've been able to make of myself with what was little expected. I have a friend who's a member of the Kennedy family, and he told me that his father wouldn't have been happy with him if they built a wing to the White House and named it after him. That so much was expected. And my friend struggles with envy. He told me this. He was just sharing this with me that he struggles with envy. And I told him that was the burden of being born around the most successful people in the world. So there's all sorts of ways, right, one can be privileged. But you're right. I've been so thankful that I've never had to struggle with envy. I've just been grateful for every little thing that's come my way.
But even envy is more of the blatant version, but there's also this sense that we all feel like we're in that rat race, like we've got to keep up with the Joneses, we've got to be seen as such. How do Christians kind of use the Catholic social teachings, as you were talking about, to try to actively police that in our own lives so that we're not motivated by the hypocritical concept, and I mean that in the original sense, which is we're putting on a mask for society to see us, but we're trying to really bear witness to the truth, come what may, and regardless of whether it gets us favor with the community, we want to advance the social status ladder up. You know, how do we implement the social teachings of the Catholic Church to guard against, because I think we have this compartmentalization where it's like, well, I'm not blatantly jealous, but there's a sense in which, well, I really want to be seen in the clique. I want to move up the social status ladder, even if it's in a Christian group or a conservative group or a whatever, a Catholic group or any type of clique that we want to be a part of.
Yeah, or maybe you don't want to be seen. Maybe, you know, I don't want to tell people I'm pro-life because I don't want to leave the clique. I think more likely than not, today, it's not wanting to be a part of something. It's not wanting to be kicked out of something, that you're afraid to say something that's going to put you with the out crowd. Because there is such a radical conformity that's demanded in us from the beginning, that we're all kind of naturally conforming. But if, you know, like me, for example, we don't vaccinate. I don't, you know, I wasn't vaccinated until I went into the military. We are what they call anti-vaxxers. Well, you know, my wife's like, honey, don't bring that up. We don't have to be controversial on every subject, you know.
Yeah.
If people look at you and they want to talk to you about abortion because just what you do for a living. But do you have to go and tell people we're anti-vaxxers? And
right.
She's funny. She's like, in fact, let them vaccinate their kids. I want everyone to pickle their kids, you know, then we don't have to. But you know, you're right. We don't want to, we even, you know, me. So I'm like, okay, honey, I won't bring it up. So I'll be at a dinner party and someone will be running their mouth about how irresponsible anti-vaxxers are. And I just sit there and nod my head and my wife gives me the dirty looks and keeps elbowing me, not to say. So yeah, it's right. Because, but again, David, I think that the goal is to take our eyes off of ourselves and keep our eyes on the victim.
Right. That's kind of what I think that the Christian approach to all these issues looks very much like radical voluntarism or libertarianism in the way it deals with law, but it has a different way of getting there, whereas traditional libertarian enlightenment style arguments in the Anglo tradition, as you alluded to earlier, focus on me, my rights, my sovereignty, my inalienable right to shoot a machine gun in the air on the property line of my house in front of children riding their bike while I'm smoking marijuana. Like, that's the cartoon idea of what people have in mind when they hear libertarian rhetoric. And I'm not going to try to castigate that, but what I'm saying is, if we focus on saying, okay, what about your neighbor? Do you have the right to use violence to scapegoat your neighbor and throw them away, right? And if you focus the shift from not me, but what is my obligations to my neighbor, it changes the focus. It makes it an attractive alternative to the victimism of our age, because it's actually dealing with victims as they happen, from the unborn to the person incarcerated. So yeah, let's summarize this in a way that people can understand. How can we get involved with what you're doing to spread this message, whether you're Catholic or not? Maybe someone wants to be a part of what you're doing to advance these social teachings that can build a kind of new momentum in the imitation of Christ in America. What are some things that people can do to follow what you're doing? Maybe there's a, do you have a study guide or a book coming out? Or,
well, I do actually. I have a book called The Race to Save Our Century. It's available on Kindle. At Amazon.com, I have a new book coming out this month called The World is on Fire. And I'd appreciate you to read my books and go to our website, surveillanceusa.org. Of course, the most important thing you could do is make a massive donation to my organization. After that, you're pretty much good. But sincerely, if you're listening, David, I know if they're listening to your podcast, they've been initiated into our little secret society. And what we need to do is cultivate what it is that all of us already know. And what is that? That there is nothing more precious or more beautiful or awe-inspiring in the entire cosmos than your neighbor, you know? And just falling in love with our neighbors. That's it. And I would say that if you're a Girardian, and I bet you've had this experience, and why I tell people, if I wasn't a Catholic, I would be to Rene Girard what Bob Marley was to Haile Selassie, right? I would make a religious cult around the man, because what I think he communicates so well in his writings, in his lectures, in the tone of his voice, in the look in his eyes, is that this is a man that was having a love affair with the human person. That he knew who we were, he knew who he was. And he wishes that everybody could see the human person through his eyes. And I think you have that, your listeners have that, and I have that. So that's it, just to deepen our love affair with the human person, to try to become more passionate, more faithful, more self-sacrificing. And I know that as a libertarian who is Iranian, that word self-sacrificing is almost an offense. But But the key word there is sacrifice. I'm not demanding others to make sacrifices. You know, there's the old Mexican saying is mi casa, su casa, my house is your house. It's not your house is my house, right? It's perfectly acceptable to say mi casa, su casa, my house is your house, my shoulders are your shoulders, my bank account is your bank account. But we should never mistake that to mean the opposite, that I have the right, David, to tell you what to do with your shoulders, to do with your bank account, to do with your house. No, that's yours. But we are called as Christians to live a life in radical solidarity with the vulnerable.
Well, very good. Thanks again. And this is Jason Jones on the A Neighbor's Choice podcast. We're glad to have him and check out his work. He's busy on several fronts, and his message is more timely than ever. Thanks again, Jason.
Thanks, brother. Thank you.